Welcome back to Deep Thoughts. Today I want to talk about a subject that I've wanted to talk about for a while, but it's sort of esoteric, so I had to kind of wrap my mind around it a little bit. But this one's going to be about something that we do every single day, but no one really ever talks to us about it. And again, that's where the show's core charter remains, which is stuff we always do, but no one ever really talks about it. And it's about making decisions. We make decisions all freaking day, every split second of our life. I mean, it is quite frankly the most amazingly regimented thing that we do, from when we get up out of bed, how we get up out of bed, what do we do right after we get out of bed, how do we handle our rituals in various areas of the house and work, and how do we drive to work, and do we make the phone call, and do we send the email? I mean, like, it's constant. And the trouble is that the more we get overwhelmed by the sheer number of decisions, the less effort we typically put into or can afford to put into the quality decisions that we're making, right? So I want to break down sort of the different types of decisions that we make and their various levels of severity, and see if we can't do something to maybe increase the more important ones. And it doesn't matter. Like I always say, your whole life is run by the little tiny decisions that you make. The tiniest decision that you make is the one that changes your life forever. And, you know, the ones that you sit down, you super duper contemplate, you'll find in the end, those don't hold a candle to all the little teeny ones. You know, it's like a death by a thousand needles is sort of how the little decisions stack up sometimes. So what kind of decisions do we make? Well, the human body is an interesting metaphor that you can compare to decisions. The human body has an autonomic system which runs your whole body, right? You don't have to concentrate on your heartbeat. You don't have to concentrate on any of your blood cells, any of your mitosis, or any of your metabolism elements. You don't have to really concentrate on any of your neurons firing a particular way. And everything's vitally important. It's equally important. Now, we can sever an arm and keep living. We can sever a leg and keep living. We can just break a bone and it'll heal. But there's certain vital organs that if they get damaged, we're done. We're absolutely done. And I want to suggest that the categories by which we make decisions sort of fit into that metaphor. When you're a little kid, you're barely conscious of anything that you're doing, right? You're sort of this amazing feral creature, sort of exploring the world. And as you bump and scratch yourself and push the boundaries of your behavioral training from your parents, you either get disciplined or you don't. There's a lot of philosophies on how to discipline a child. Some parents believe that if they ever discipline their child, then they've cut their child's balls off and they don't grow up to be aggressive people. Coming from parents that were extremely strict on behavior and essentially in the element of being polite and being, I don't want to say sophisticated. I mean, they definitely taught me how to do that as well, but they were... I wasn't able to ever act up in a restaurant, right? My father tells a big story that I cried once at a restaurant, and I must have been about 2.5, 3 years old, and he just took me out back and spanked my butt and said, "We done?" And I said, "Yes," and we came back inside. I don't remember this at all, and I behaved. And, you know, it's funny because it's sort of like when I had my kid, she was also a behavior. We didn't have to do much to her. We just taught her how to behave from the very moment she was born, instead of waiting for her to become out of control and then trying to discipline her later, which would, I think, in my opinion, confuse her even more, because I've made it okay for her to do whatever she wanted up to that point, and then all of a sudden I clamped down. So instead of making it a disciplinary action, I made it a, hey, nope. It was like she's walking a straight line and I just was kind of like the blinders. Nope, nope, yep, oh, yep, nope, yep, nope. And it was just pleasant the whole time. And Dad was just this cool guy that protected her, and that's the way it works, right? So that's sort of how my family did it too. And again, I was pleaser early in life. If I was ever anything else, it was always outside of the family paradigm. So when I acted up, it was always kind of by myself. But the reason I mentioned that early childhood is that we go from this sort of nebulous, chaotic creature that's just trying to figure it out, you know? And again, if you subscribe to a soul and a body, then you obviously have this soul that has lived in the universe. And I don't mean religious soul, just your spirit energy that is sort of boundless, right? Maybe boundless by time, maybe boundless in every parameter. And it's just beautifully exploring the universe and it can't hurt anything. And so it's just looking around, all of a sudden it attaches to this form, which is us. And then it's got to figure it out. Who knows how it works? I'm just saying that, you know, that we grow up and we start slowly, slowly making conscious decisions. But when do you make a decision to make a decision very specifically? You know, because we were instinctual creatures at first, just like all the bugs in the world. We're just essentially trying to survive. And as our hormones kick in, we're trying to procreate. I personally believe that the second you make automatic decisions that eventually result in a negative is the moment that you immediately try to make a better decision. So for instance, you might effortlessly, like when I was a kid, I was 3 years old. I remember this quite vividly like it was yesterday. And I saw a bee climbing on a little plant, little like flower in front of my daycare. So the flower was cool and the bee was cool because bees are always drawn as your buddies in kids' books. I had no idea this thing was a threat to my safety, right? And consequently, I didn't know if you breathe on a bee, it gets pissed off and stings you because it thinks it's being attacked, right? So I grabbed this bee and I let it crawl on my finger and I'm just staring at it. I'm like, oh my God, this is the most amazing thing I've ever seen. And it stung me. And I was like, of course, you're going to shock. You're like, oh, my God. And, of course, the daycare woman runs around. I got this pulsing stinger in my finger. And, you know, we pull it out. And it was sore the rest of the day. And so not only did I make a bad decision to pick up a bee, but the sore at the end of my finger reminded me every day until it was gone. Of course, it turned into, like, this little purple impression that was a bad idea. It was my decision. I got stung twice by wasps around the same age, but those weren't my decisions. They just found me and stung me, you know. I'm sure I did something to piss them off, but I wasn't aware. This particular conscious decision was my decision. And that was the moment that I know that I realized I got to make better decisions. And I need to be more informed about better decisions because part of me subconsciously understood that no one had taught me about the threat of a bee. But here I am picking up a bee, right? So that's where it all started for me, in my opinion. So all of us go through this feral stage and we get into this sentient stage. Now, I think the number one kiss of death is thinking that every decision that we make does, or that a bunch of decisions that we make don't really matter. We don't really need to make heavy decisions or heavy due diligence on certain decisions, like figuring out the risk of certain decisions, you know, before we make them. And of course, there are small things that don't really matter. And then there's, you know, I'll give a logistical example, but the other one is, you know, the really super important ones, you know, that control your destiny. But let's say that you have a bathroom ritual, and I'm just going to use this as a ludicrous example on purpose. But let's say you do a certain regimen of how you set up your bathroom in the morning, how you use your bathroom, how you break it back down to get ready to go to work. You know, you want to clean everything up. And you haven't really put much thought into it. But let's say that you're trying to scrape every second of time out of your life, you know, so you can do it. And I don't recommend doing this too intensely because you will get to the point you stress ball yourself up and you give yourself cancer from being too anal about things. But once you set something up, that's you then can exercise that routine and it's stressless, right? So you put a lot of due diligence in at the beginning and then it just becomes effortless afterwards. If you make a bad decision about how to set that whole situation up, maybe you eat up 3 to 5 minutes that don't need to be eaten up because of the way you pulled it off. Now, maybe that makes you more relaxed and happy. That's the reason to keep it exactly that way. And that's the benefit of your decision-making process. But if you're like me and you don't really care about your bathroom ritual, but you just want to get it over with as soon as possible, you know, then you're going to shave off various stages. Where do you store things? You know, do you put things in four or five layers of cupboards, or do you just keep it on the top in some little bag so you can get to it quick, use it, and get out? All those tiny decisions in that ritual will determine how much it consumes, right? And if you make a weird decision, then you add that up times 365 times a year, and you see how much time you've actually consumed out of your life that maybe you'd rather have put someplace else. That's a horrible example, but that's an example of where you might have other rituals in your life after you start your day that may consume up time that doesn't need to be consumed. And sometimes the way that you arrange your home can yield back a lot of time or consume a lot of time. And again, if it makes you happy, keep that decision. That's really just as beneficial as optimizing something left brainy like time, you know? Now, if you're like me, obviously very quickly in your life, you realize that doing due diligence and which just means taking a look at all the facts that are circumstances around the decision you're about to make to figure out the risk and that kind of thing, you do it very casually as a young person. And as you get older and you start dealing with professional organizations, you start to see that they do very professional analyses on the elements of a decision. And there's always this thing called risk assessment. You know, if we make this decision versus that decision, what is the risk to the organization based on these different decision branches that we can choose at this point? And it wasn't until I entered really corporate America that I realized that that was what they did. And what sort of struck me as odd was that, why is it only at the corporate level that I learned that? And again, I got into corporate America very quickly. So I was 18 by the time I started in corporate America. So I got a crash course very early. But then I thought, well, what if I had had this brain trust when I was 7, 8, 9, 10, somewhere in there? As I'm making decisions, now I got really lucky when I made decisions about how to spend my spare time. I happened to pick ones that just really benefited my entire lifespan, you know. So when I decided to draw, that was good for me, and paint and whatever. When I decided to get into computers, because my uncle was a programmer in front of me, it was a good idea. When I got into sciences, it was a good idea. But I just lucked out. And I think that, you know, both as a child trying to manage their lives and a parent trying to manage a child's life, there's a lot of benefit to formalizing and understanding that decisions are something that are important, that we make as accurately as possible, right? Now, a lot of us have had that fantasy, especially if you're over 30 at least, but definitely 35 and over, of you think, you know, even if your life's fantastic, you still think, my gosh, what if I could go back and do it again? And all you're saying to yourself when you say that is, I'd like to make all the decisions again. I'd like to make better decisions. And a lot of times it's based on knowing where the future goes. You know, a lot of us who are involved with internet ventures, we think, oh my gosh, have we got involved with the internet before it actually hit and splashed? Would have been an amazing thing, right? Consequently, I actually had a venture land in my lap. I think it was 1989, 90, somewhere in there. And a guy came to me and said, there's this new thing coming. And he didn't call it the internet, unfortunately, but he said it was a network of computers that are going to be around the world and people are going to start selling things. And he had all these businesses set up. And I just happened to be living with a family that was unbelievably wealthy. They owned a giant forklift company. And they created the company from scratch. And I brought the whole venture to them. And I said, you know, look, I'm a computer guy. Not only can I get these computers and create services on them and connect them to all the other computers, but we can sell items. And there's a bunch of vendors all ready to go. The banks are ready to take money through this network and all this other stuff. And they simply said, well, you know, we invested in the steel company 2 or 3 years ago and lost all of our money, so we don't invest anymore in anything. I got in at the ground level of the internet before HTTP protocol was really circulating around, but I would have been involved with the modem call-in base stations for local network connections and would have been able to sell items through this service. And it would have taken a few years to mature, of course, but, you know, Amazon was selling books in 1993, right? It's funny how that happens. But again, I would try to go back and convince them to make a better decision. I was a child trying to pitch this to them, and I was probably 19, 20 years old trying to pitch this to grown adults, and I didn't have my due diligence and obviously wherewithal about where the internet was going, or but the internet was going to exist. You know, the internet's been around since the 50s, early 60s technically, but it wasn't until 69 they really gave it off to the universities and we know it as the internet, you know. But the whole fantasy about going backwards is interesting because it's almost a rhetorical lesson for the now. Man, it's interesting. We often think that what we're in right now is the toughest thing we've ever been in sometimes. You know, and of course, we all can sit around and rationalize tougher times in the past. But the mind, because it doesn't want to remember the past, writes it a blank check and gets rid of it. You know, there's a Twilight Zone in the fourth season about a guy that's a toy designer, and he's just a little boy in his brain. He's a grown man. He's like 38 years old, but he's a toy designer and he just designs toys, but he's a child. And sort of where the movie Toy came from, and with Tom Hanks, or no, Big, excuse me. Sorry, Big. But he's this in this Twilight Zone. This guy's a kid, and he keeps reminiscing about his childhood and how great it was when he was a kid. And he keeps going back to his neighborhood where he was a kid, and all of a sudden he's back in time, and he's watching all the little boys he used to play with, and watching all the grown-ups, and he's interacting with them. But it's always the same sequence every time he goes back. Every other night or so, it's always the same sequence, and he always drops his watch, and a little boy brings his watch back to the future. It's really weird. And his wife always answers the door, and the kid goes, "He dropped this," and the wife thinks this. Her husband's crazy until this kid just keeps coming back and coming back right at the same time every day. But she's still in denial about the whole Twilight Zone experience. But what ends up happening at the very end is that he goes back and he finally experiences the past as it really was, which is he got beat up as a kid. And they beat him up. They beat him up because he turns into a child on his last visit. He's watching them as an adult, and all of a sudden he flips and he's a child. And they beat the crap out of him because he didn't invite them to a birthday party a long time ago. And he ends up just passed out on the ground, and his wife can't find him. It's his birthday. There's a surprise party at his apartment. She goes out and tries to find him, and she finds a little boy on the ground. And, of course, in cinematic drama, she turns around and leans against the wall, and she says, "Oh, my gosh, this is the craziest thing." And she turns around, her husband's in the boy's place because it's the same guy, and he's beat up just like the little boy. And they finally get up, and they walk back out in the street. Now it's modern day. But it's real late at night, no one's around. And he says, "You know what, I finally remembered that my childhood actually sucked. You know, it wasn't great. I got beat up all the time. This wasn't good, and I don't know why I ever thought it was great." And she just says to him, "You know, that's what we do. We only remember the good times. We don't remember the bad times." And I tell you that little anecdote because when we fantasize about going backwards and making better decisions, I say if it makes you feel good, do it. Just as an exercise, hey, but then realize that maybe your life was like that guy in the Twilight Zones, and maybe back in the past, it was just as tough as it is today. And all we can do is make better decisions today to live a better life. And so that's why I want to make this episode so that we, you know, again, this is one of these things where we're all making decisions, but we simply don't talk about it. You know, and you know, if you're in a business class or in a business college, you'll take classes on making better decisions and doing due diligence and risk assessment and all that stuff. But what's weird is you can be going for that graduate degree in business and getting all this advanced knowledge about how to run your business, but you might be the only person that comes home to your household and applies that knowledge to your household. But I tell you what, I know a lot of people that have those degrees and make great decisions when it comes to business, but they come home and it's like their fucking brain was erased. You know, they can't manage their children well. They can't manage the happiness in the household, right? And it's weird that they would lose the faculty that they use at work from home, because they simply go home and they go, "I can't control my elements at home like I control a business," right? You can't just tell a child to behave and he just automatically behaves. You can't tell your wife how to do what she does because she's her own individual sovereign human being. But honestly, at work, you can't do the same. You can't do that either, right? I couldn't force that family that I was renting a room with to take on the internet at its inception. I couldn't force them. All I could have done is pitch them better to make a better decision, make a more educated decision. But I didn't have the due diligence in my mind as a maybe 20-year-old kid to convince them to do so. Actually, now that I think about it, I think I was about 19 when that happened. So how do we formalize this? How do we learn something between the two of us right now? Because your brain might be swimming right now. You might be going, "Oh, you're right," and I'm a great decision maker. I know how to. I've done great things. I've made big empires and businesses, or I've done one other thing that's great. Money doesn't mean you made a great decision. It might mean you make great decisions if you amass a lot of wealth. But if you're simply happy, that's really where you're going to start to prove to yourself that you actually have a really good brain, really. Now, what if you're a great decision maker? And maybe you listen to 5 minutes of this and you're like, "Oh, dude, I totally get it. I'm gonna take that, a skill of mine. I'm gonna make sure I'm applying it everywhere in my life." And it's really fun when you learn that you can do this to every part of your life. But then you have to live with other people, like I just said. Your wife and your kids, or your husband and your kids, or your family or your friends or whatever. You know, and we're going to get back into making better decisions in a second, but let's say that you think already that you make great decisions, and now you have to campaign your decisions into other folks to get them on your side, right? I have acquired probably 6 books that are related to getting people on your side. And it's definitely an art. And unfortunately, scam artists are really good at it. And the other flip side of it is that sometimes it takes a tremendous amount of work. And this is where your empathy gene is going to serve you extremely well. I've said on previous shows that I actually had this bizarre email relationship with Steve Jobs. And I just started approaching him in the mid-90s before he jumped back to Apple. I was actually emailing his Pixar account at the time. And I don't know what it was, but I was able to engage this guy on a level that he would reply. And over the course of, I guess it was probably 96 when I finally got him to reply, to about 1999, I finally engaged him in a business proposition, and he responded immediately because he already knew me, you know, through emails. And I met him, I think, in, I want to say 2002, face-to-face. I was invited as an honored guest and stuff to Apple, but he was always never at his office, that kind of thing. He was never at his office. But he would send his, you know, the CFO of Apple to me, Clint Richardson, and he'd send all of his top dogs. And the way that started was that I saw things from his perspective and addressed things from his perspective. And you can imagine being Steve Jobs and a bunch of people trying to convince you to do one thing over the other, right? Because you're the ultimate decision-making person at the top of this Apple pyramid. And so everyone wants you to do what they want you to do. And there's maybe like when Apple was, in 1995, Apple was so screwed up as a company that you know, you could sit down for hours and listen to people lament about what needs to be fixed first. And I'm willing to bet that everyone could make a case for virtually every part of the products that they were making, from the operating system to the hardware, to peripherals, to relationships, to licensing, to where they should go after they fix all these problems. You know, we should start designing the future right now. I mean, it could go on and on forever, right? And so my decision was to engage him on a level that was sort of subtextual to all of those requests. I thought of, you know, obviously I had ideas about where Apple should go, but it wasn't anything profound. And the first time I ever got him to respond was he had taken an interview. He showed up to the Apple show, I think, in 1996, when they sort of brought him on stage. Gil Emilio brought him on stage, and he did the famous presentation. Everybody was just crazy over the fact he was going to potentially come back and run this company, and which was exactly what he did. But he took an interview after that. He got off stage and they were asking him questions, and he was recorded by a lot of the local magazines as being very cantankerous and swearing a lot and just speaking his mind. And I think he was utterly valid in doing that, in terms of he was showing his genuine nature and his frustration and his disgust for where Apple had gone, because the entire time he had to watch it from the sidelines from 85, just make one bad decision after another and give everything up to Microsoft, right? So this sort of started making a buzz around the industry, right? The internet was just budding. And so I got a little bit concerned that was going to be his return mantra, that he was going to essentially become a cantankerous old fart and that no one was going to want to listen to the guy. And I sent him an email and I said, you know, I'm very glad you're back. You know, again, this isn't the first email I've sent him. So, but I said, I want to suggest that the way that you talk to the press be heavily designed. You know, and he'd always done this in the 80s, right? But he had sort of, you know, he had had Next Computer not really go anywhere, but it was superior technology, which now is the absolute foundation of the Apple products. And I just didn't want him to slip. And so I quoted to him some things from the philosopher Kenneth Burke, who really studied language and the way that it molds your brain. You know, now I know it's actually a Marshall McLuhan regimen as well. But just to say, look, you're crafting the way that they think about you. You're crafting the limitations of their perception on you by coming in this wild card again, this young kid that's sort of a rebel, you know, and you're being rebellious against the establishment, et cetera, et cetera. And he replied to me something very short. I can't quite remember exactly what he said, but it was essentially like, thank you, and you're right. And I never heard him quoted ever again in public as being really cantankerous. Now, behind the scenes, everyone says, you know, he definitely let everybody know what he felt, which is important. And it's sort of the Jack Welch candid chapter out of his book about being honest. If you can't be honest with your employees, there's no way you're going to get where you need to go, right? But again, what I did was I made a decision to come at him from a level that no one was really engaging him. Everyone's too afraid of Steve. You know, the people said that if they rode the elevator, they didn't know they're going to have their job by the time the doors opened. And I thought, well, I'm not employed by Steve. I have nothing to lose. And as long as I'm fair and just and empathetically try to feel like, where does he feel the most alone in his life? You know, because he knows he's flawed. Everybody knows they're flawed. But no one was willing to engage him on that level. And I'm sure his family was just trying to provide support. So I might have been one of the only critical voices that was constructive in his life at that point in time, which is maybe how I penetrated the veil of communication with that man, right? And it really paid off later in life, you know? So when you make decisions, or you want to make a decision, or you want to change something in your life, and you need to have folks on board, I want you to really study how the other person is being engaged constantly. Now, you may be a person that nags the living crap out of your family and friends already, and so your best bet is to pull back, almost go dead silent, and just be a positive spirit in their life and reverse their perception of you as being that person that's always applying pressure in a way that maybe, even though it's right, it might be it's too much. Like, they need time to grasp what you last said and make a better decision based on what you last said to them. And if you come back with another idea and another idea and another idea, you're just this pounding force in their brain that won't, it won't be inviting, right? I've had buddies of mine, you know, you sit around and you talk about the opposite sex, if that's what you're attracted to, whatever you're attracted to. But they would say, you know, like a couple of my buddies that were back in our 20s, they were like, I never can get the girls. And they were like, I don't know why. And I said, well, tell me what you're doing. What decisions are you making that is either not working or working? And what I discovered with my buddies is that they would operate from a perspective that's only their perspective, what they want out of that person. And the best piece of advice I realized that I could give these guys is I said, look, at the end of the day, when we survey our life, we we try to figure out what was positive in the day and what was negative in the day. And I said, if you can make yourself the positive person in anyone's life, however that's done, and hopefully you're not enabling them, right? If you have an alcoholic friend of yours, you don't want to enable them to drink more and ruin their life, because then they will eventually wake up most likely from that disease, and you're going to be the catalyst to their demise. You don't want to be that person. But if you're whatever they need, you're an empathetic ear that listens to them, and you actually listen to them, you're not worried about what you're going to say, you totally just divorce your time and you give it to them and you try to work with them, or you're just this benign, positive spirit. They want to go to a movie and you're like, yeah, let's go to a movie. And you don't bring up anything controversial. You don't ask them about their life. You just have a great experience picking them up in the car, getting the ticket, getting the food, going in, laughing your ass off or crying your ass off in that movie and coming out and then going home and drop them off at a good time. And you're just this positive person. I told my buddies, I said, look, whoever you're trying to attract, whether it be a buddy or a girlfriend or whatever, they're going to keep you in their life, and they're going to keep you as a foreground character in their eyesight, and they're always going to think of you when it comes time to do something. Now, again, when you come to attraction in life and relationships, you're going to need to push the buttons that are in the other realms of engagement, but that'll at least get you in the door. And when they interact with other people that are more self-absorbed, which is, you know, a lot of times you'll be in love with someone who's in love with someone who's not good for them, you know, and eventually they just keep getting hurt by this person. You know, some people are, masochists, and they like that hurt all the time because they like the chemical dumps in the mind that negativity brings them. You would have to be one of those abusers to attract that type of person. But if you're a normal human being and you just want to have a good, positive life, that's the way you do it, you know? So what can we do day to day to make better decisions? I'm going to tell you that the best thing you can do is look at all the other decisions you could be making. When you write a screenplay, for instance, it's a massive example of how you should run your life. And that's why I always tell people, if you can ever go see Robert McKee, McKee, his writing class, which is pretty damn expensive nowadays for most of us. It's about $800. They have a reoccurring discount if you go. I think it's somewhere around there. You'll learn a lot about life, because you're always writing characters, making decisions. That's what a character does. You know, the way that you define a hero is what your hero does under pressure, the decisions they make under pressure. But you know very well that when you make a decision, all right, there's a thing called instinctual decisions. People say, follow your gut, always follow your first decision. Maybe you can. If you're racing a race car down a track, you don't have time to take a moment out of your life to whether or not you should pass them or cut them off or do whatever. You have to follow your instincts constantly. There are some things where you don't have the time to make decisions. If you were skydiving and there was an accident or something, man, you've got maybe two decisions you can contemplate before you make the right one, and you do whatever you got to do to get out of that peril situation, right? But if you have time, and most of us do have time in our life, you want to start to analyze everything that could happen. And the reason why I mentioned screenplays is that what we're supposed to do as writers is you say, well, I had this vision of a film, and the hero does this. If you do not go down every other branch and every other branch of every branch, right, that character could have made instead of the one you arrived at the screenwriting software thinking about, Hollywood's going to eat you up alive. And you won't usually find the best story that you're looking for. Maybe your premise is fantastic and your story idea is fantastic, but if you would just contemplate every potential decision that this character could make, within reason, of course, you won't find the best story. And that's your life as well. So how many times have you made decisions, split-second decisions, that affected your life for the rest of your life? And I don't mean cataclysmic things like you stepped off of a curb and you got hit by a car. That happens too. But ones that you actually, no, there's no pressure, man. You're sitting at home in your front room, you're sitting wherever the hell you're sitting, and you're just making decisions. Like, well, I got to make a decision. And you don't you don't contemplate even two ideas before you make a decision. Walt Disney was famous for asking people to illustrate things and say, okay, you're responsible for making this particular character. And people go off and draw that particular character and they bring it to him. And he was famous for saying, they'd say, well, what do you think, Mr. Disney? Is this good enough? Should kind of roll with this? And he'd said, well, it's really tough to make a choice when there's only one choice. And they all of a sudden learned a big lesson from him. In 2 seconds, they realized he needs choice. He needs five choices, you know, whatever. He needs more than one choice to really figure out whether or not it's the best idea. As he learned the hard way of making one character and going with it and it not being the best choice. Again, Mickey Mouse was not his first character, right? Now, the other thing about making decisions is that we get myopically focused. We hone down and focus on one decision, and that's not bad. But let's make sure that you have a full perspective of your life when it comes to making decisions in general. The unfortunate thing about us humans is that we actually tend to ignore life and decision-making processes until we get ourselves in a pinch. And then all of a sudden, we have to make better decisions. For any of you who have ever overdrawn your bank account, you know exactly what I'm saying. You weren't paying attention to where you spent your money until you get that little notice on your telephone that goes, hey, you're overdrawn now. Or you try to pay a big bill and you can't do it. And then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, you know, and it almost gets exciting where you're like, okay, I can't do this, I can't do that. I'm going to eat top ramen every single day, and I'm going to buy regular gas instead of premium gas, and I'm not going to go to that party because it's 80 miles away, and that's one way, and it's going to be 160 miles round trip. It's going to eat my tank up, which means I'm going to fill up my car, blah, 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 right? Let's not wait until we get into a state of disarray before we start making good decisions. Now, everything I'm saying, I expect it to go into your mind, and maybe for a few days or a few weeks, you make these make this part of your regimen. I expect you to forget, and then I expect you to get bit, and then I expect you to come back to it. That's natural. Don't beat yourself up, right? You might even go, God, I just listened to that episode on making better decisions, and I wonder if I made a bunch of bad decisions, right? Don't worry. It's life. It's, again, it's one battle at a time, and every day is a new battle, which I like to be careful saying that because that sort of sets up your day to be negative, but it's truly just a process. And we're silly if we feel guilty about life, because life is just chaotic, right? So if you've done any type of motivational courses of any kind, you will undoubtedly and it depends on how old you are, but someone's told you that if you think your life is in complete disarray, one of the things you can do to your life to make it feel better is to get a pad and paper and start writing down everything you think is horrible about your life. And I mean everything, just in a list. And the challenge that most of these guys will say is that you'll really struggle to get to 10. But if you are asked before you do the exercise how many horrible things are going on in your life, you're like, oh my God, dozens and dozens. It's not true. In the end, there's only a few things that are really horrendous. Now, you might get to 10, but study your list to see especially if you prioritize it or what you think is the most horrible thing to the easiest thing you need to fix. I'm willing to bet around 5, you've started to dial out to some pretty elective stuff, you know, and it's not the end of the world sort of thing. You know, and if you have 20 bills you can't pay, that's not 20 things on your list. You simply say, I need to pay 20 bills. I got money problems is really where the big problem is, right? Now, definitely there's bills that you need to pay first and bills that you can put off. So what I would suggest you do before you run into that problem, if you're in that problem, do that exercise and you'll find it really helps you out. But if you can write down everything that you want in your life before you get into a problem. Again, the list will be actually fairly short, and that's fine. My gosh, isn't that great? If you could just say, I only got one thing on my list because I only want to do one thing, then you're balling, because you can focus all your energy on that one thing. Now, most of us have multiple things, right? Don't be surprised if, you know, the major ones are just 3. Again, that's great. And again, I want to encourage you to go back on my regimen of self, family, work. Those are your three categories in life that you need to manage with your decision-making process. And the most important one is self, because without self, you can't engage those other two hemispheres very well, right? So if you're not the shape you want to be in, then engage self, because everything else will get better the more you feel better. And again, if you, let's say you're 50 pounds overweight or something like that, or you're actually perfect size, but you're just flabby and you want to get back in shape, just a couple visits to a gym, a couple visits to maybe not eating bad, you know, and you just work out in your house. Again, I work out of my house. I've been to a gym a few times in my lifetime, and I really don't like them. But believe me, I've gotten seriously ripped right here on this patio in a matter of 4 months. You know, and I go in through regimens. It's wintertime now, so it's a little harder to work out here, but I still stay on it. But when I am kicking ass and taking names with my health, because it's a priority of mine, I feel great. And everything else is sort of like, yeah, that's, I'm going to be able to do that. And you also exude in yourself your frequency of confidence and your frequency and happiness, that no longer am I going to wake up with this shadow over my head, which is my perception of myself not being what I want it to be. Right? But the reason why I say you want to write down everything that you want to do with your life and anything you need to fix in your life is that as we make those decisions, they're related to other decisions. Right? So a lot of times we get focused on a decision that's really, really important for our life. And let's say you do the whole thing where you do all the due diligence, you go down all the branches that are related to that one decision. And you look back and you're like, well, I've got this particular decision really worked out. Now, maybe you can do that. And that's not uncommon. Probably 50-50, you can do that without worrying about other objectives in your life. But it might be that half the time, whatever you're making a decision about is going to affect the rest of your life in different areas. And I'll tell you a classic one that happens all the time. You can get a job that pays a tremendous amount of money, solve all those bill problems, but you got to move. You have to move to an area of the world that you don't think you're going to like. And again, you would have to inform yourself about whether or not that's actually true by going and visiting the location for an extended period of time. Nothing else, stay at a friend's house in that area. If you can't do that, get a week rate at a motel and stay at that motel for 7 days straight. And drive around, eat at all the restaurants, feel the temperature. If you think you're going to live in a particular neighborhood, go and visit that neighborhood in the morning, in the afternoon, in the evening, in the middle of the night. See if it's quiet, if that's what you want. See if it's a party block, if that's what you want. Get yourself informed as much as possible, and then maybe the decision isn't so hard to make. I live in Southern California, and I can tell you right now, if I were to pick up everything I own and go back to the Bay Area in Silicon Valley, I know that whatever I'm making in Southern California, I can probably make twice as much money in the Bay Area. But I lived there for 12 years. I know the area very well, and I have a lot of opinions about that lifestyle and that cost of living that I simply do not want to live there. And so I've probably had in the last 2 years offers to make a tremendous amount of money up in that area. But I simply said, well, at most I'll commute up there. You know, just cover, and it's part of my salary, either pay me enough that I can handle it myself or make it part of the travel regimen. You can write off all the travel so that I can fly up in Monday morning and stay maybe 3 days and then come back for 2 days here. Worst case, I fly up for the whole week and come back for my weekend because it's a little half-hour flight, little jumper flight. I got a great airport down the street. And if, you know, actually the person that offered me the last time actually resigned out of the company. And I didn't know he was actually going to be doing that. So when he left, I pretty much closed the door on that opportunity. But I made an informed decision. And so, you know, you might be making decisions and you're married and you have children. Your children have friends in their neighborhood and great schools, and your wife has a job and she loves the area and you just know where all the grocery stores are. But then you get this job that might pay twice as much money. And there's a tremendous impact psychologically picking up everyone and moving. And I was a kid that was moved around quite a bit, so I can speak from experience, right? Now, sometimes I hated moving, but in the end, when I sit here and talk to you, I know that my entire life I've been not afraid to travel the world, especially America, and I've never had a problem making friends because I always had to make new friends, right? And I got lucky because I started out my my parents' hometown after we came back from Germany. Started out in my parents' hometown when I started waking up and becoming sentient. I got my chops, but I got to about second grade. And then I moved away to another little town in Kansas. And then I moved to Massachusetts. And then I moved back to Kansas. And I went back to my little hometown. I got to finish up high school, junior high and high school, in my beautiful little hometown. So I got very fortunate that I got to come back. And I had friends waiting for me when I got back. And it was a little awkward at first, right? Because there's some kids I don't know that always trying to beat up the new kid. It's crazy. Little did they know that Boston taught me everything about fighting, and these kids had nothing on me. It was really funny. But, you know, so I want you to make a list of things that you want in life and just draw lines between them. You know, just get a piece of paper, draw them anywhere on the piece of paper you want, and then just draw those crisscross lines like when you were a kid playing games, like which two things belong together? You know, milk, cow, hay, horse. You know, it's like draw any lines of association between these things and try to find out which side of the equation is the priority, and put a star by it and say this decision is probably going to drive that decision. Oh, by the way, there's a second line that's going off to something else, which is maybe my kids' friendships, you know, and you want to make sure that you're not impacting anyone negatively, right? I know you feel me on this, but I'm just sort of beating this up from different angles. Now, let's talk about risk assessment for a split second. This is something that businesses do constantly, and we don't do it very well in our normal lives unless you've made a bunch of mistakes or made a couple big mistakes, and then you start to become paranoid about your decision-making process, right? When you start a business, there's usually three categories of decisions that you'll make that are the most important categories that you'll ever experience in your business. The number one decision is, do you start your business? Do you really have the clientele lined up? Do you really have the ability to replace your income with your business? And usually I like to say, you know, have your clientele, have a big client that's going to be at least a year's worth of work. And you have an agreement with them, a contract with them to pull out of them every month the amount of money that you need after taxes to survive, right? Second decisions you'll make is how to grow your business, how to find new clients, how to always be closing, as they say. You will have an interesting situation. When I used to run my company, we used to have, if you look at it like this, your employees are your assets, right? And as much time as they work is, you know, when they work on something, their value is extrapolated into income and goes into the company. So in the video game business, when I used to run my company, we'd have a big, giant Fortune 1000 company come to us for a project. Might be worth $1 million. And then we'd have a really exciting project come in. You know, those clients are exciting too, but what if the kiss of death for video game companies was getting involved with the film business? And they'd say, oh, we have a new Terminator movie coming out, and you're going to create the website with all of the video games, or we're going to create the website, and you're going to create a bunch of video games with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. And these people get starstruck. And they go, well, definitely we want that because the portfolio power of that particular piece is going to be worth a tremendous amount of money. And sometimes you're right. But I'll give you a couple lucid examples about that. These companies don't want to spend any money. And it's getting a little bit better in the film business. But I happen to know a lot of people in the film business. I know what they pay for things. The average poster that you would go up and see at the theater on the wall before the movie comes out that's supposed to lure you into buying $15 tickets to see the film, they would spend from $750,000 to $1.5 million to some schmuck sitting in a room stitching together this poster, because they know it's such an important piece of marketing that if it doesn't get created correctly, no one's going to see the movie. But that's like a 1995 mentality, because there wasn't internet marketing, right? And there weren't any other arteries to advertise your film. Now there's a million ways to advertise your film, and the poster may not be seen at this point. And the kids that create it, the talent base that can create a poster is so vast that you no longer have these couple guys sitting in their palatial mansions on the Hollywood Hills creating posters, because they have that one skill that no one else has. There's a ton of kids that have that skill now. Composition skills, storytelling within a single frame of imagery, you know? And so what would happen is I would watch them cut a check to someone creating some incidental piece of information for $1 million called a poster. But when we needed to create a multiplayer, fighting game with thousands of frames of animation, sound design, the most elite coding possible, it's going to run through a web browser. And of course, they think since web browsers are free, that everything should be free because it's a web browser's free. It was completely the inverse. It was more expensive for us to create this game than that guy to sit down and create the poster. But they wanted to pay us something like $50,000 for a game. Well, they're going to cut $1.5 million to some dude creating a poster. Completely had their old man minds upside down as to where the money needed to go to really create a glue to make people see the franchise for what it could be inside the theater. Right? So as the CEO, I always had to make these tough decisions. Go off and create something that was slightly less glamorous for a Fortune 1000 company for $1 million, or try to take the same resources for the same amount of time and put them into something that is, according to the layman, more sexy. And, you know, I don't think I ever made the decision to take the small guy, but sometimes it would be a $100,000 project versus a $50,000 project, and I start looking at the portfolio quality. Sometimes people want to pay us a tremendous amount of money for a throwaway, where it was something extremely ugly. Like they would say, we're not letting you draw the video game. We want you to put together our artwork to be a video game. And so we knew that as soon as it went out, we couldn't claim the art portfolio. And as soon as you don't create the art in a video game, you can make it function beautifully, but no one's going to want to use your services because they think you make bad decisions, you know? So I've actually pulled out of projects because they're going to be ugly and unusable in our portfolio. You know, we couldn't claim that work. So in terms of the algorithm of always closing new business, I knew that I was going to have a sort of a vacuum in my ability to say what have we done lately, because we can't show off this project that might take 8 months, you know, and because when you work with novices, it usually takes a lot longer than they think, right? And time is money. So when you bid that thing out, if you don't bid in the cushion for them being novices, you'll end up eating money and you'll end up paying them to take the game off your hands. It's horrible, right? The other one that I've had to do is that I get involved with the company. Usually I'm working with their CEO because I was the CEO of my company, and I would start to figure out who the partners are. Where's the money coming from to pay for this venture that they're buying from us, right? And under one circumstance, I had a client for about 4 years, and they kept losing their CEO, and they kept getting new partners and new investors. And there was a point where actually I needed to get the cash from this company. I really needed to make payroll and rent because it was during the 2008 crash, you know, in 2009. And the company came back to me and had this grand vision, but they weren't going to let us draw the artwork. All right. And we started doing conference calls with this company, and they started bringing in these guys and said, this guy's a total expert. He's the greatest at video game, blah, blah, blah. I was like, if I don't know you, you're not the best for damn sure. Right. And so I started looking up these guys' portfolios on LinkedIn, on Facebook, looking them up on all the credit sheets all over the internet. And I realized these guys are nobodies. All they've done is they have blown smoke up the ass of all the investors, and they're the same age, which is old. And they were going to take this company down. So I actually pulled out of a project that I had actually closed the deal. I designed the game and closed the deal and had the resources available. And I simply called the CEO and I told her, I said, you know what? I'm going to pull out of this project because I think that you're going to run out of money before I'm finished. And I'm going to be owing my employees money and you're not going to have it to cut me the check. And of course, this woman who was the CEO at the time, she just said, I don't totally disagree with you. She said, but the investors have made a stipulation in the money that we have to use these dinosaurs to get the game done. And I said, well, I think your company's over. I think your company's done. And within 2 months, they folded. And this project was a 6-month project. So I avoided a horrible decision for my company by doing the due diligence and figuring out who are the players in this equation. And I saved myself a lot of hardship, you know. Now, I've also been duped by people that had spent a lot of money with me over years. My last client, spent probably around $600,000, just shy of $600,000 over 4 years, which for this individual's company was very small, and that was a fair amount of money, but we did a massive amount of engineering that had never been done on planet Earth, liaisoning with a lot of services in the stock market industry. And he routinely was late on his payments, but he always made his payments, no matter what. In fact, he took like 6 months the very first time he racked up an $80,000 debt with me. But we had a lot of money coming in from other areas, so we were able to float him on his debt, and he eventually paid us off. And then he came back with several $100,000 fairly consecutively, right? He might be late 30 days on his invoice, but he always paid. So at the very, very end, we got the tool, this game, to a really cool level. And he asked me for a float. And his monthly nut was about $40,000. And I had asked everyone involved with the project to work at a 25% discount, saying, look, if we get this thing where we need it to be, it's going to blow up and we're going to be sitting pretty. And so all my buddies gave me 25% discounts. Well, it turned into a 2 month float. So I was into it for $40,000 worth of gross profit, and which I have to say about 80% of that was my nut. Before I paid for the rent, before I paid for the electricity, before I paid for everything, benefits and that kind of stuff for my employees, I was out 80% just in their payroll alone. And so I started putting the pressure on the guy to settle up the invoice, and I finally had to tell my folks, don't do any more work for him. And this was our last huge client at the time, because the internet had, you know, the economy had totally tanked everybody, you know, and we were going through this mobile transition where the mobile market was so saturated. And this was a mobile game as well as an internet game. And he was incapable of paying his debt, and he made a couple mistakes on his end, and they weren't going to cut him a check. And so we ended up having to sign a little deal where I made just a fraction of that money back, and I had to use the coffers of the company to pay off all my employees, and we lost a tremendous amount of money. And at that point, I just said, you know what? I think I'm gonna take a break from this industry for a while until it settles down a little bit. And it's still really chaotic right now. You know, the biggest franchises on Earth can't make money. You know, there's a lot of Star Wars games out there that are eating every month. They're eating hundreds of thousands of dollars in red ink. Because the industry is so upside down right now. And the talent base has really shrunk. You know, you have guys, I don't know how they keep their jobs, but they must be amazing, you know, kiss asses to keep their jobs and constantly create these negative cash flow video games. It's interesting with these promises that at some point it's going to turn black. You know, well, as soon as Star Wars releases as a movie, it's going to make this crappy game all of a sudden entertaining. It's like, no, it won't. No one, and you're going to just be responsible for driving this company, you know, $2-3 million in debt. Good luck on the next job, right? But the other decision you have to make when you're in a company, and I'm telling you this story because you can apply this to your own life, is when to close your business. When do you make the decision that you simply can't keep the momentum going? Maybe you don't have the resources, maybe you don't have the partners, maybe the industry itself has dried up, which is sort of where I was. And you know, we were like Alexander the Great. You know, we cried because there were no more worlds to conquer. Our company went into the very niche market of online multiplayer flash games, and we eventually branched off into mobile. But we were creating these platforms that didn't exist anywhere else, and so we were rewriting the biggest companies in the world. We were recreating their platforms. Sometimes we were credited for doing it, and sometimes we were paid not to say that we did it. And we made millions of dollars off these folks, right? But then, you know, Steve Jobs walked on stage, bastard, and I say that lovingly, but he said, you know, Flash is dead, HTML5 is going to take everything over, and of course, HTML5 to this day can't survive in the industry at all. So even though there's books coming out day after day after day, how to make a video game in HTML5, it doesn't work. It simply cannot be done properly. It doesn't work on mobile devices, and every browser argues about how the commands are happening. So once I saw that climate where the decision makers at the top of these companies were buying the propaganda about Flash being horrible, and it's a shitty product in some levels, right? But they were starting to finally make the product better, and their CEO or CTO at Adobe, who's now over at Apple, that guy, maybe he was repressed from doing what was right, but I never seen a a product make bad decisions more consecutively than that, than the group led by that individual. And I have to say, since he's left, it hasn't really gotten much better. So it probably isn't that individual, but, you know, we experimented with the HTML5 thing. And I'm telling you this example because sometimes your decision-making process is not completely owned by you. Sometimes you're trying to make a decision and you're coupled with other individuals. Could be a spouse, could be a business partner, could be a buddy, and you're not in full control of the situation. And, you know, that's just life. That's what you have to do to collaborate, right? We had a major, major institution called AOL come to us to make a whole slew of HTML5 games. And immediately we looked at the games that they were trying to make and we said, okay, we're going to create some sample apps that essentially test the performance capabilities of what you want to do, how many parts you have on the screen, see if we can move them fast enough to actually have the frame rate that you need, which you traditionally get in either a mobile app or you get in Flash. And we came to the conclusion very, very quickly that this wasn't going to work, that you couldn't move the parts on the screen fast enough, even using their special canvas object, which allows you to blip things really quickly. You couldn't do it. And so we said, you know what, we'd love to take your money, we'd love to be involved with these projects, but unless you redesign the products to be far more primitive and have less moving parts, which we're experts at too, slowing things down and basically keeping the gameplay but removing, you know, 2/3 of the anatomy on the screen, it's not going to work. And so they weren't going to compromise. They said that there was some other competitor company out there they were talking to that was capable of doing what we said was impossible. And we're like, bullshit, bullshit, dude. When we conquered Flash, we conquered high performance algorithms like no one else in industry. That's how come my company did so well. So we were the only ones on earth that could actually make a game in a really tight space, tight memory, tight CPU usage. So I bowed out, and it was like, we had other clients, so it was no big deal. So I bowed out of it gracefully. 6 months later, both those individuals at the company were fired. And they were fired because they took the company down this HTML5 route, promised everyone above them that it was possible. They themselves knew nothing about video games, knew nothing about the due diligence on how to make a good decision. They had bought the promises of this, I guess it was a foreign company, non-United States company, promising them all this stuff, blowing smoke up their ass, and they lost their jobs because they made bad decisions. They didn't do any due diligence, and they didn't know what they were talking about, which comes to the bumper of this episode. The only way you can make a good decision is to know what you're talking about. How many times have you ever heard, only write what you know? How many times have you heard, only invest in businesses that you understand, right? So if you're a big real estate mogul, and you want to go, you got just gobs of money in the bank and your accountant's saying, look, we got to put this somewhere. You have to invest it somewhere. And, you know, obviously if we had more real estate to invest in, we just roll it back into what we know, but we don't. So we got to go off into some other ventures and we got to do it quickly. And these guys go off and they put their money in something they don't understand. They get had. And a lot of times what I've seen by, being involved with rockers and the music industry and film, I've seen hooligans take people for money, which is horrible. They pretend to know what they're talking about. They put up false credentials, and it's in such a way that you can check the credentials and they check out, but they're actually all fake, you know. But I've seen people put money in things, and I've actually recommended, unfortunately, a couple of my friends to get into ventures that I thought were going to work out, and they flop. And in one particular case, I was the venture, and I had a partner that wasn't capable of delivering, although he had previous things he had done. He actually could deliver, but he just lost his constitution. He lost his daily grind ability to keep going, and so we lost one of our ventures. Another one was a guy in the film industry who pretended to know what he was talking about. He did have kind of a dangerously minimum amount of money that he put into projects to make it look like he had a ton of money, and he ended up running away with a bunch of money and left a lot of people in the industry just gasping for air, going, I cannot believe I just got had by this guy, you know. And my friends have been in the industry for 35 years and done all these amazing things, but they still can get had by a new guy coming in from a different industry. So as you look at the decision-making process and the decisions that you know you need to make, what I want to say is, do the math on how much you understand the paradigm of the decision that you're making, right? Now, thankfully, I think in most cases, we do know what we're talking about in most cases. Now, there's some nebulous areas like love and relationships that are just going to have to be fought through trial and error, you know? But you can also find advice in those really nebulous areas, people who have succeeded, but they've been through the same trials that you've been through. Now, let me just tell you the kiss of death and the romantic area, just to give you an idea of chaos and I guess you can just say chaos, chaotic areas of decision-making process, such as love. Let's say that you want to be in the most perfect relationship in your life. And so you think, well, what I'm going to do is do what you do in business, and I'm going to, and I'm going to give you a business example as well, but I'm going to go talk to a super couple, a couple that has been married since they were high school sweethearts, and they've always been able to make it work. I never see them fight, and I'm going to talk to them to figure out how to get it right in my own life. And they might be able to give you a lot of great advice, especially if they've had some trials and tribulations where they maybe nearly got divorced, or one of my buddies had a kid, his first child, and he said, man, it almost made me divorce my wife, and she almost divorced me. You know, it was a mutual hatred for each other, so we were trying to figure out how to raise an infant and work, you know. But a lot of times, those super couples are built out of super couples, like they're compatible people that are amazingly compatible. They think either complementary or supplementary, or they think alike, and they don't really have the daily struggle that you might have with another individual. So asking them for advice is sort of luck of the draw, because they don't know what your struggle's like. Maybe you're directly incompatible with the person you want to actually spend the rest of your life with in your mind, and you're trying to ask someone who has complete compatibility with the other person as to how to manage this other individual. Your best bet would be to try to find someone who had a horrible beginning with like, oh my God, we thought we would never make it work, and we did. And it was this little change in our perspective of each other and our communication style and our daily regimen that made it all kind of balance back out, and it worked. Again, I got no advice in this area that I would say would be worth making an episode about. Just know that one person's success doesn't equal your success in those chaotic areas. Now, business-wise, there's a guy that wrote a book, and I forget the damn name of the book, but it's a beautiful book that goes back and looks at some of the greats in the software industry. And I think it branches out in a lot of other industries, but the software industry is a perfect way in hardware industry where people say, you know what, I'm going to start a game company, but all I'm going to do is copy Steve Jobs. I'm going to copy Bill Gates, because these guys without degrees were extremely successful. So if I just figure out how they made good decisions, I'm going to have the same success that they have. And in the end, it's not about their decision-making process as much as their opportunities at that era in history, right? Now, what's weird about it is you might convince yourself that it still has value for you, and it may. Usually communication styles are what you can steal from people, right? Donald Trump is very boom, boom, boom. He's like, what can I do for you? What can I do for you? What can I do for you? That's how he rolls. Steve Jobs was very much that way. Steve Jobs was, I know what I want to do, and either you're on board to help me do what I want to do or get out of my way. Bill Gates, he just fell uphill his whole life. You know, he happened just to be involved with a company that made a bunch of decisions around him. He was the forefront guy eventually, but the guy never wrote any code after maybe 80, you know, and he just had great people under him, and he had a lot of mega corporations that wanted to put Apple down, and so they're like, we need someone else to copy this great idea called a GUI. Look at how Apple's done it, steal it for no money, and make a copy, while Apple's paying Xerox $110 million in stock, you know. So they always say Apple stole it from Xerox, and it's like, no, $110 million worth of stock, and what, 79? Tremendous amount of money they paid for that, the privilege to use a GUI. Opportunity is a huge part of your success model, and that's why you probably want to be very careful copying people that have just been in the right place at the right time. Now, you might find yourself in the right place at the right time, and that's the time to move, you know, but doesn't guarantee anything. The only reason why we know about these famous people that have succeeded so incredibly is because they're sort of the action hero in the action movie. They always succeeded. And to give you a little bit of a sort of a survival of the fittest, or maybe even luck, I don't know, algorithm that'll blow your mind, and you don't think about it that often, but this is sort of how those individuals need to be assessed in your mind before you copy them. Let's say we had a sport of some sort, any sport, shooting, playing video games, basketball, football, soccer, football, right? And we have a playoff with 1,000 teams. Let's say we find 1,000 teams to do this. And video game competitions, with the arena competitions, there are 1,000 people. There's more than 1,000 people. And you know that if you do a playoff chart, right, it's usually sideways in a kind of a point, but let's make it like a pyramid. Everybody loses but one person. Eventually, everyone loses except for one person. And it's a miracle that we can recreate that situation anytime we want to hold the arena. So say you have 1,000 video game players, and they're going to play Pac-Man, for Christ's sake. And it's whoever has the highest score on any one given competition, right? There's two machines side by side. One guy's going to play, and one guy's, two people going to play at the same time, and whoever gets the highest score goes to the next final. One person, guy or girl, is going to win every single time until they get the trophy at the top. And we can recreate that anytime we want with any division of labor, any division of anything in life. But we know we've just created an anomaly out of statistics. And that's how a lot of successful people have made it. We talk about them having made all the right decisions. That kid who pops out at the end has made all the right decisions to win at the top. Now, maybe it just, you know, the guy they're playing next to has a cold and he can't pay attention. You know, the guy's wrist hurts from a previous game. You know, whatever. Randomness makes some people lose sometimes, but it pushes you up further. And so essentially you're falling uphill. And so when you worship people that have made it really, really well in life, we have to be extremely careful. Did they really, really battle it out? You know, they say Thomas Edison made 10,000 light bulbs before he figured out that the vacuum was important, figured out how much, you know, voltage to push through the filament to not burn it out, to make it last, and et cetera, et cetera. That dude fought his way to a light bulb. You know, he had to pick himself up. Let's just say the analogy is correct, 10,000 light bulbs. Well, he had to pick himself off the ground 9,999 times to continue making a new light bulb until he finally got it. That's a guy busting his balls to succeed. That's a guy picking himself up off the ground. So those are the type of people that we really want to focus on if we want to usurp someone else's capability of making great decisions to succeed. We can't always just say, you know, these guys at the top are always the people that you would admire. Take from them what you like. If they talk in public and you happen to feel more comfortable, Steve Jobs was an amazing stage performer. Steve Jobs mastered what words to say on stage, you know. And I think you'll find that from maybe, the late 70s to the early 80s when he exited the company, he did make great presentations. He beautifully built up a beginning, middle, and end to every presentation he ever did. You know, his presentations of the Apple Macintosh, of other products, you were just on the edge of your seat constantly because he knew how to ebb your chemical flows in your mind, just like a good movie, getting you to the point where you just cried when you saw the Mac talk in its first incarnation, 84, right? Because he was showing you something you'd never seen before, right? When he got to the 90s, he had so refined his presentations through next operating system and next hardware presentations where he sort of tanked. He didn't really tank, but he, you know, wasn't persuading people to get rid of the other products and buy his product. So by the time he got to Apple, he was like, you know, you got 45 different desktop computers. We're getting rid of all of these. We're going to make four computers for the four different cylinders that match the demographics of people who buy computers. Your average consumer desktop, your average consumer laptop, your professional laptop, your professional desktop. That was it. Four units. That was it. And he made those four units as amazing as he possibly could with the talent that he had. And everybody was convinced. And it was a slow crawl. You know, then he came out the iPod and the iPhone, the iPad and all that stuff, making great decisions one after the other. But believe me, the dude labored through his decision-making process to come up with those refined approaches, right? We have to do that with our own life. So to summarize, okay, this is very important because I've just meandered around. I want you to be conscious of the process of making decisions. As infinitesimal as how you get up in the morning to living your entire day. And maybe you're doing nothing more than affirming that the decisions that you're making are fine. I'm good. This is good. I don't have any problem with taking a little bit longer. I like to sit and drink my coffee slowly and have a cigar in the morning to, you know, optimizing every split second of your life. It's up to you. Make sure that you also measure your physical reaction to the decisions that you've made, the regimens that you've made. If your decision-making process makes you stressed out, then you got two decisions. Ease back, or realize that you're going to, just like driving a car, when you first start driving a car, you're really tense because you think you're going to kill someone every split second. You're going to wreck the car and piss off dad or whatever, right? You know, eventually you don't even think about it. You drive to work and you can't even remember driving to work. You know, did I take that street or did I have any stoplights? I don't even remember. This is all autonomic. So if you do increase the regimen of your life, you may want to ebb it in small increments, deal with the stress of that until it feels like you're driving a car 20 years after you started and it's much easier, right? Realize that you need as many facts as possible around the decision that you're going to make. You want to take your decision down alternate paths, you know, in your mind. Conceptually, think of at least two decisions. Like Walt said, you can't choose from one. At least come up with two different paths you could take. And you may surprise yourself. You may think, this is ridiculous. I know exactly what I want to do, and there is no other option. And then you go, well, what if I did have to come up with an option? And you come up with an option, you're like, oh my God, that one's actually a little bit better. You know, how much money you spend on a product is usually where a lot of people make decisions. Yeah, I know people that can afford anything they want in life, but they still pinch their money, and that's why they get to keep it. You know, my friends who come into money suddenly, they then go off and spend it all, and they realize then they're broke, and they're thinking, what the hell did I do wrong? How did I lose all that cash? Well, you didn't make good decisions about how to spend it. All those lottery winners that go off and become destitute, you know, they increase their responsibility to banks through loans, and maybe they even just buy a house and they completely own it, but they need a staff of 10 to service the house and keep it clean, and they can't afford that anymore, so they have to short sell the home and they lose all their money. So make sure you look at different options and make sure you get as much information about each option to figure out whether or not there's a risk there that you'd rather not take. Thirdly, decisions affect other decisions in your life, right? So you might have two paths you need to go down. They seemingly don't have any relationship with each other, but you know if it's going to happen to you, these two decisions are coupled at some point. Make sure one doesn't combat with the other. If anything, try to make sure the two decisions augment each other. They make them more powerful, right? I think lastly, I just want to say, sometimes you got to pull out of decisions that you've made. You've made a decision to commit to something. You know you're not a quitter. You have a choice. If you can finish a regimen of what you decided to do, like you commit to something, you're like, man, this is really isn't going to be the best use of my time. I got better things I can do. But maybe you got some people on the line that need your help. You know, it's almost like you have a major deadline with group A, and your buddy asked you to help them move 2 months ago. And so you said yes, but you didn't know this other thing was going to collide with that decision. So you have to make the decision of whether or not to cut them, who you're going to cut loose, who you're going to actually jeopardize. You know, maybe you can end up finding a way to do both in the same day. Maybe tell your friend who needs to move, you're like, look, I've got this thing. I didn't realize this is going to hit me. I got this really incredible deadline. So here's what I'm going to do. I thought I was going to be able to spend 4 hours with you helping you load, unload. I'm going to let you pick. Do you want me to help you load or unload? I can only do one of the two parts of the job because I can only give you a couple hours. I can't give you all four. Something like that. But know just like a business, when you need to make the decision to pull out, sometimes that could be the best decision that you ever make, is not to do what you were going to do. And don't feel guilty. Just know it's part of the process, right? I know you guys feel me. I hope this has been very helpful. Again, if nothing else, if you just got 5 minutes into this and you realize, oh my God, yeah, I do need to really think about decisions that I make a little bit more than I have in the past. And know again, it's going to come and it's going to go. You know, you're going to be really aware of your decisions. And the more you make great decisions by doing all these techniques, it's going to ubiquitously dissolve out of your consciousness that you can need to continue that due diligence in future decisions. Don't beat yourself up if you find yourself down the path and you're like, oh my God, I totally forgot. I got to make good decisions. I got to really do these techniques to benefit myself the most. Just get back into it. Right when you figure out you don't have it, go back into it. Don't feel guilty. So go off and make some good decisions, you know? And if you guys have any advice always recommend you guys post things down below if you got other videos or people are doing a much better job recommending this kind of stuff than me, then we're all for it. If you haven't already, go to mkultureradio.com. It's all there. If you haven't subscribed, please subscribe. If you haven't liked, please like. I moved the cigar reviews to another channel. So if you guys are interested in the cigar reviews and you're like, where the hell did they go? You can go to Real Time Cigar Reviews somewhere on YouTube and you'll find them. That's about it. Anyway, if you haven't already, learn the rules that rule you and take care of yourself and somebody else. Over and out.